He was indeed largely responsible both for my present journey and the previous ones, having pressed me to undertake a thorough study of the Tibetan language Vid literature. I had followed his advice, and the growing interest in Tibet which I had derived from my study had finally led me, after years of travel, to the Dalai Lama's own capital. Had I given my name, and had he been free, he might have liked to see me again, but his present Western suzerain does not allow him as much freedom as his Chinese master did. Whatever may be his own inclinations, he is no more at liberty to welcome a foreigner who is not sent to him, than he is to forbid his door to those who are recommended or delegated to him. So I went my way. We crossed the river Kai and ascended a small pass. There I looked back for a last vision of Lhasa. From that distance the Potala alone could be seen, a tiny castle suspended, it seemed, in the air like a mirage. I remained for a while gazing at the graceful vision, remembering the toils and troubles that my stay in Lhasa had cost me. I had had my reward. In a heart-eatened glum I wished spiritual enlightenment and material welfare to all beings visible or invisible who lived in the forbidden city that had been hospitable to me, and then, turning to the south, I began my descent. Lhasa had forever gone from my eyes and taken its place in my world of memories. Quite near Lhasa, on the left bank of the Brahmaputra, one finds a miniature Sahara whose extensive white dunes are invading the whole country. One can observe there, though on a much smaller scale, a phenomenon like that witnessed in northern Kansu and in Chinese Turkestan, where the Gobi has swallowed up immense territories occupied, centuries ago, by flourishing estates. In spite of a ridge which stood in their way, the sands have taken a firm footing in the Kai Valley, and though still shallow on that side, their fine dust is beginning to accumulate along the hedges which border Norbiling, the pleasure garden of the Dalai Lama. It may possibly be that in a few generations Lhasa will be reached, who knows whether, in a still more distant future, some savant, excavating the entirely submerged city, may not discover the Potala and the Jokhang, just as we how lay bare the palaces and temples which the sands of the great Gobi have overwhelmed. On our way we passed the monastery of Dorje Thag, most picturesquely situated against a rocky cliff on the river shore, with a small village at its foot. Farther off there were a few more villages whose fields are gradually disappearing beneath the mounting sands. That snow-white desert region through which the Brahmaputra, like a huge azure snake, winds its way serenely, imparts to the same monastery a peculiar air of mystery. Traces of miraculous events are pointed out all over the country. A high isolated rock, standing strangely in the bed of the river, bears witness to one of the most remarkable of these prodigies. Once upon a time this giant had removed from India toward the heights of Tibet. What was the goal of its adventurous journey? One cannot tell. Perhaps it felt impressed by the calm beauty of the wide Brahmaputra valley, its turquoise sky and its blue river, and, struck with admiration, its enormous bulk came to rest upon the sand. Since then, an unbroken trance has held it there, alone in the desert, its feet bathed in the stream. I envied it as I passed. Like it, why could not I seat myself on the shore of the Blue River, and remain there forever, wrapped in solitude, sunken in unshaken rapture? Same is an historical site. In the 8th century after Christ, the first Buddhist monastery of Tibet was built there. The legend tells that the demons, determined to prevent the erection of the building, pulled down each night the work done by the masons during the day. The famous magician Padmasambhava succeeded not only in conquering them, but in compelling them to become his obedient servants, and with their aid he built the monastery in a few nights. The same monastery has long been the seat of powerful lamas, but since the establishment of the Yellow Cap sect and the superiority acquired by it over the Red Cap, in becoming the official clergy of the state, same has lost its importance and is now an abandoned place where can be found hardly more than 20 trippers. A number of houses inside the large enclosure of the monastery are now inhabited by the lay tenants of the Gompa and have become small farms. Yet the few temples still remaining in the deserted monastery are kept in good condition. As successive fires have destroyed not only the original buildings, but those which have replaced them, The present edifices are not of great interest, yet one of them deserves special mention, for it contains a most dreaded shrine and is the seat of one of the great official oracles of Tibet. This shrine is called Yukang, House of the Vital Breath, because it is said that the breath of every being who dies on the earth is carried in it. There, in an inner room sealed with the seal of the Dalai Lama, are placed a chopping board and a knife of ritualistic shape. With these implements the devils each night cut up invisible corpses and, so say the Tibetans, one can hear from outside the noises of the chopping mingled with cries and laughter. The oracle of Sami alone is allowed to enter the shrine once a year to deposit a new chopping board and knife. The old ones, which are removed, are then seen to be worn out by the use that has been made of them. That breath which can be chopped seems a somewhat extravagant invention. It is but the popular gross interpretation of some esoteric beliefs and rites of the Nagspa. Stories to make an ear's hair stand on end are told concerning the Yukang. Struggles of tortured breath against ferocious beings of another world, thrilling escapes of ghosts in search of the body which has been theirs, racing with infuriated female devils in pursuit of them. All the elements necessary to a first-rate nightmare may be gathered in the tales to which the Yukang has given birth. Years ago, when the Lama Chosky Ongo entered the shrine, he was allowed to be accompanied by a few members of his ecclesiastical household, but a dramatic incident put an end to that privilege. Once as he was on the point of leaving, the Chosky Ong, Sanskrit, Dharmapala, or protector of the religion, Chengzde, who followed the Lama, felt as if somebody was tugging at his zenna from behind. "Gusho! Gusho!" he exclaimed, addressing the Chosky Ong, "somebody is pulling my robe." Both men turned to look behind them. The room was empty. They then continued to proceed toward the doorway. Just as he was about to step out after the Chosky Ong, the Chengzid fell dead. Since then, the Lama alone enters the abode of the Eaters of Breath, as he only is believed capable of protecting himself by the recitation of secret spells. Outside the door of the shrine one can see a number of leather bags which represent the invisible wrappings in which the breaths are carried to the Yukang. There exist, say the people connected with the shrine, sorcerers who, while in a trance and unconscious of what they do, perform the peculiar function of seizing the breaths of the departed and bringing them to Sami. But I must cut short this account. The field of the occult seems boundless in Tibet. Occult lore may be studied at all stages and in all forms, from the most absurd, degraded, and repulsive, to those whose manifestations give cause for reflection and contravene all preconceived ideas. Beginning with the ignorant quack who treats the villagers with words and gestures, the meaning of which is as unknown to him as to his clients, we may, before we arrive at the aristocracy of magic and witchcraft, make the acquaintance of many picturesque personages who roam about the country or remain rooted in retreats extremely difficult of access. Incidentally, in the course of the preceding chapters, I have mentioned the Mopas, who predict the future and discover hidden things, the vagrant Naljorpas who, aping the true ascetics of that name, pretend arhat they can command the deities and the demons, and Tapasvos and their female colleagues the Pamos, a variety of mediums who deliver oracular pronouncements in trances. The smallest fry of these last grovel miserably in the towns and villages, offering their services in exchange for food, while the greatest among them are highly honored, Lord Libiji semicolon Nyas comma living in sumptuous abodes and occupying, under the title of Chosky Ong, high official positions. There is also in Tibet a curious class, including persons of both sexes, but especially women, who are reputed to be hereditary keepers of poison. What poison? Nobody knows. No one has ever seen a trace of it, but this very mystery adds to the terror it inspires. When the fatal times arrives, the one who is to administer it cannot escape the obligation. In default of a passerby who may afford him an opportunity, he must pour it out for one of his friends or relatives. One hears whispers of mothers who have poisoned their only sons, of husbands who have been obliged to hand the fatal cup to a dearly loved bride the day of their marriage, and if there is no one within reach, the keeper must drink the deadly potion himself. I have seen a man who was said to be the hero of a strange poison story. He was traveling, and on his way through a village he entered a farm to obtain refreshment. The mistress of the house prepared him some beer by pouring hot water upon fermented grain placed in a wooden pot, according to the custom of the Himalayan Tibetans. She then went upstairs. When left alone, the traveler remarked, with some astonishment, that the beer placed before him, in the wooden vessel, was boiling in great bubbles. Nearby water was also boiling in a cauldron, but in a natural way. The man took a large ladle of this, and emptied it over the suspicious-looking beer. At that moment he heard a fall on the floor above his head. The woman who had served him had fallen down dead. This poison is a source of great worry to travelers in Tibet. There exist peculiar wooden bowls, which, it is maintained, are sensitive to the presence of poison in any beverage poured into them, and for that reason they are sold at very high prices. Strange to say, in Sejin households the family is convinced that the mother possesses poison. Where does she hide it? Nobody tries to find out, for all are convinced that there is no cure for such a fatality. They look askance at, spy upon the gestures and words of the unhappy woman, who in the end often comes to believe that this poison of hers really exists. Even the death of the tormented person does not put an end to the danger. The poison seems inexhaustible. It is transmitted, and the legatee has no power to refuse it. Willingly, he is obliged to become a poisoner in his turn. It must be understood, however, that when they administer the poison, as well as when they bequeath it to a successor, these keepers are acting unconsciously, as the passive agents of another will. Nor do they remember their action afterward. The Tantric rites, in the course of which the participants eat a piece of the flesh of a corpse, and others still more extraordinary, the art of prolonging life with all the energy of youth, by seizing upon the vitality of others, levitation and so forth, all these are practiced, it is said, by small groups professing esoteric principles. There is an order of Nagspas whose members are reputed to be experts in the science of killing, slowly or suddenly, from a distance. They are also said to be able to chase away evil spirits or to send them to attack some particular individual. This gives rise to amusing comedies. A man who desires to harm another from jealousy or some other cause, sends for a Nagspa, begging him to dispatch a devil to worry his enemy. The magician casts HJS spell, but the peasant, merchant, or noble lord against whom the rite is performed may learn what is going on. Then he has recourse to another Nagspa, and the play begins. On his arrival, the evil spirit finds an adversary whom he cannot conquer, and returns in anger whence he was summoned. His irritation makes him dangerous, and it is essential that he should promptly satisfy his ferocious instincts. For that reason is sent back again, and once more finds himself overpowered. This game of ball, at the expense of the poor devil, may be prolonged, his fury becoming progressively stronger. Each of the Nagspas, then, must look out for his own safety, for he who cannot master the invisible spirit will become K.S. victim. It is rare, however, for things to take a tragic turn in performances of this kind, as in other more occult affairs which sometimes bring madness and death to those who attempt them. Usually the peregrinations of the evil spirit only serve as a pretext for each of the wizards and his assistants to sojourn in the house of his credulous client and feast at his expense. Certain objects, having been used for magic rites, must not, according to the popular belief, be kept in the houses of the laity or the non-initiate lamas, for fear that the beings who have been subjugated by means of them may revenge themselves upon their present owner, if he does not know the way to overpower them. To this belief I owe the possession of several interesting objects in my collection. People who received magic implements through inheritance have often entreated me to take these two dangerous legacies from them. One day a gift came to me in a manner queer enough to be worth relating. In the course of a journey I fell in with a little caravan of lamas, and, conversing with them, as is customary on such travels, where encounters are rare, I learned that they were transporting a ferber, a magic dagger, which had become a cause of misfortune. This ritualistic weapon had belonged to their head lama, recently deceased. It had begun its misdeeds in the monastery itself. Of three monks who had touched it, two were dead, and the third had broken his leg falling from his horse. The high pole of one of the large benediction banners suddenly fell, and this was an ominous portent. Terrified, yet not daring to destroy the fervor, for fear of yet greater misfortune, they had deposited it in a box, whence, soon afterwards, lugubrious and threatening sounds were four-eared to issue. Finally they had decided to lay the dread object in a lonely cavern dedicated to some divinity. But the cowmen living in the district had opposed this. They recalled the story of a ferber, which though when and where nobody knew, had, under similar conditions, begun to wander through the air, wounding and killing many men and beasts. The unhappy bearers of the magic dagger which lay, wrapped up in papers with charms written upon them in a carefully sealed box, appeared very sad. Their discomfited countenances forbade my rallying them, and I was, moreover, very anxious to see the evil implement. "Let me look at the ferber," I said. "I may be able to find a means of helping you." They dared not break the seals and let it free, lest it escape, but finally, after a lengthy argument, they allowed me to take it out myself. It was an ancient and very interesting specimen. Only the great monasteries own ferbers of this kind. Envy was aroused in my breast. I wanted it badly, but I knew that nothing in the world would induce the lamas to sell it. I must reflect a little and think out a way. "Camp with us this evening," I said to the travelers, "and leave the ferber with me. I will look after it." My words promised nothing, but the attraction of a good supper and a gossip with my people, who would distract them from their worries, decided them to accept. When night fell I went some distance from the camp, openly carrying away the dagger, the presence of which, out of its case, while I was not amongst them, would have terrorized the credulous Tibetans. When I judged that I had gone far enough, I stuck the cause of the trouble upright in the ground and sat down on a blanket to think out how I could persuade them to give it up to me. I had been there for several hours when it seemed to me as if the form of a lama arose near where I had fixed the magic dagger. I saw it advance, stooping cautiously. One hand came slowly forth from beneath the zen which enveloped him, and appeared in the indistinct light to grope for the ferber. With a single bound, quicker than the thief, I reached it and dragged it out of the ground. So I was not alone in desiring the mischievous implement. Among my chance companions there was someone, less simple than the rest, who knew its value and wanted to sell Kay secretly. He had believed me asleep, he thought I would perceive nothing, and next morning the disappearance of the dagger would be attributed to some occult influence, and a new story would be the result. It was really a pity that such a fine plan should not succeed. But I had secured a magic weapon, and held it so firmly in my closed hand that my excited nerves and the pressure of my flesh on the rough surface of its worked copper handle gave me the imp's sign that it was moving slightly. And now for the thief. All around me the immense stable land was empty. No doubt the marauder had been able to effect his escape whilst I was stooping to snatch the dagger from the earth. I ran to the camp. It was quite simple. The one who was missing, or who came in after me, would be the thief. I found them all awake and chanting religious formulas to protect themselves against the powers of evil. I called Yongdan to my tent. "Which of them has been absent?" I asked him. "No one," he replied. "They are half dead with fright, and I had to be angry with them because they would not go far away enough to perform certain acts. Strange indeed. I had been dim-sighted, deceived by an illusion. It was not common with me, but no matter, this perhaps would serve my purpose." "Listen," I said to the men, "this is what has just happened." And I told them frankly of the vision I had had, and my doubts of their honesty. "It is our Grand Lama. Undoubtedly it is our Grand Lama," they exclaimed. "He wanted to take back his dagger and perhaps he would have killed you if he had been able to get it." "Oh, Jetsenma, you are a true Gomchenma, even though you are a filing. Our Tsawai Lama was a mighty magician, and yet he could not take his ferber away from you. Keep it now, keep it. It will no longer harm anybody." I shared their joy, but from another source. The fervor was mine. Nevertheless, honesty forbade my taking advantage of their emotion to appropriate it. Reflect, I said to them, perhaps a shadow was responsible for the vision. I may have been asleep and dreaming. They would not hear of this. The Lama had appeared. I had seen him. He had not been able to take back Eferba, and, by my superior power, I became its rightful owner. I must own that I allowed myself to be easily convinced. After leaving Samya, I crossed the Brahmaputra near Tstang, where the valleys of the Yanlung open out. This country is famous for the number of its places of pilgrimage. As to its physical aspect, it is pleasant and fertile, with nothing of the majesty of the forest of the poet, the land of grass, or the bleak tablelands near the Himalayas. Its inhabitants take agriculture much more to heart than do those of the other provinces of Tibet. Well-built houses are to be seen in large numbers everywhere, and the people appear to be in a rather flourishing situation. The charm of the mild climate and the fertile ground of the Yalung valleys have been known for centuries, and the first kings of Tibet, long before Buddhism, under its Lamaist disguise, spread through the country, had chosen it for their residence. Like a conscientious pilgrim, I visited the celebrated six places of religious interest amongst Chihita, is a cave, now enclosed in a monastery, where Rishuna, one of the two foremost disciples of the great ascetic Bodhisattva, lived for a time, practicing meditation. From that, I climbed the narrow staircase up to the opening and, gazing into it, began to reflect upon the symbol suggested by that inner curtain, yielding and refusing its radiance. I thought and thought and, somewhat forgetting where I was, remained longer than the average visitor. My forehead against the stone, as I gazed into the building. This was noticed, and the same evening, a tripper shyly asked me if I had seen many lamps. Leaving Tag Chen Bumba, I wandered in several directions across the country, in my hunt for books. Quite unexpected circumstances led me to discover, far out of the way, a lama who had inherited a fine library, and who, like many of his colleagues, did not care at all for literature or philosophy. I secured a good number of ancient and beautiful manuscripts from him. The time had now come for me to decide upon my departure from Tibet. I looked toward China, whence I had come. I felt very tempted to turn eastward, and reach Yunnan by a new road. I could, had I so chosen, have left Tibet without anybody ever suspecting my arduous journey and my stay at Lhasa. But something made me feel that what I had done must be known. I obeyed this instinct and took the road to Jiants, the town of southern Tibet which has become a British outpost. On my way I saw the strangely shaped Yamdok Lake, in which there is a peninsula with a small separate lake. Here I found the famous Sanding Monastery, the residence of the High Lady Lama, Dorji Phagmo. It was in a rather dilapidated condition. Dorji Phagmo, the diamond or most excellent so, is considered a manifestation, under a human form, of a deity of the Buddhist tantric pantheon borrowed from India at a period when Buddhism had already completely degenerated, and primitive doctrine hardly existed any longer. Many are the legends about certain of the Sandingas abbesses, who in times of danger or in other peculiar circumstances show themselves in the form of a sow. The Reverend Lady was hot at Sanding when I was there. I had seen her at Lhasa and she had not yet returned from the capital. I reached Jiants at dusk and went straight to the bungalow. The first gentleman who saw me and heard a Tibetan woman addressing him in English was dumbfounded. When he had recovered, he explained to me that the bungalow's rooms were occupied and directed me to the fort, where the officials and a small garrison of Indian troops are quartered. My arrival there produced the same effect. When I said that I came from China, that for 8 months I had wandered across unknown parts of Tibet, had spent 2 months at Lhasa and enjoyed in the Forbidden City all the New Year's festivities, no one could find a word to answer me. In any event, the gentleman at the fort welcomed me most kindly and showed me the greatest hospitality, for which I shall ever remain thankful. I had still before me the long, dreadfully cold road across the tablelands and blizzards wept that venture was ended, and alone in my room, I said to myself before closing my eyes in sleep, La Jido, the gods have won. The first white woman had entered Forbidden Lhasa and shown the way. May others follow and open with loving hearts the gates of the Wonderland, for the good, for the welfare of many, as the Buddhist scriptures say. The end.